The item is potentially useful information that might be needed for something later, or a reference. These three categories can themselves be managed. We'll get into that in a later chapter. For now, suffice it to say that you need a trash basket and a delete key for trash, a tickler file or calendar for material that's incubating, and a good filing system for reference information. Actionable. This is the yes group of items, stuff about which something needs to be done. Typical examples range from an email requesting your participation in a corporate service project on such and such a date to the notes in your in-basket from your face-to-face meeting with the group vice president about a significant new project that involves hiring an outside consultant. Two things need to be determined about each actionable item. One, what project or outcome have you committed to? And two, what's the next action required? If it's about a project, you need to capture that outcome on a projects list. That will be the stake in the ground that reminds you you have an open loop. A weekly review of the list, which we'll describe in more detail later, will bring this item back to you as something that's still outstanding. It will stay fresh and alive in your management system until it is completed or eliminated. What's the next action? This is the critical question for anything you've collected. If you answer it appropriately, you'll have the key substantive thing to organize. The next action is the next physical, visible activity that needs to be engaged in order to move the current reality toward completion. Some examples of next actions might be: call Fred regarding the telephone number for the garage he recommended. Draft thoughts for the budget meeting agenda. Talk to Angela about the filing system we need to set up. Research database management software on the web. These are all real physical activities that need to happen. Reminders of these will become the primary grist for the mill of your personal productivity management system. Do it, delegate it, or defer it. Once you've decided on the next action, you have three options. One, do it. If an action will take less than 2 minutes, it should be done at the moment it is defined. Two, delegate it. If the action will take longer than 2 minutes, ask yourself, am I the right person to do this? If the answer is no, delegate it to the appropriate entity. Three, defer it. If the action will take longer than 2 minutes and you are the right person to do it, you will have to defer acting on it until later and track it on one or more next actions lists. Organize. The outer ring of the workflow diagram shows the 8 discrete categories of reminders and materials that will result from your processing all your stuff. Together, they make up a total system for organizing just about everything that's on your plate, or could be added to it, on a daily or weekly basis. For non-actionable items, the possible categories are trash, incubation tools, and reference storage. If no action is needed on something, you toss it, tickle it for later reassessment, or file it so you can find the material if you need to refer to it at another time. To manage actionable things, you will need a list of projects, storage or files for project plans and materials, a calendar, a list of reminders of next actions, and a list of reminders of things you're waiting for. All of the organizational categories need to be physically contained in some form. When I refer to lists, I just mean some sort of reviewable set of reminders, which could be lists on notebook paper or in some computer program or even file folders holding separate pieces of paper for each item. For instance, the list of current projects could be kept on a page in a day runner, it could be a to-do category on a PDA, or it could be in a file labeled projects list. Incubating reminders, such as after March 1st, contact my accountant to set up a meeting, may be stored in a paper-based tickler file or in a paper or computer-based calendar program. Projects. I define a project as any desired result that requires more than one action step. This means that some rather small things that you might not normally call projects are going to be on your projects list. The reasoning behind my definition is that if one step won't complete something, some kind of stake needs to be placed in the ground to remind you that there's something still left to do. If you don't have a placeholder to remind you about it, it will slip back into RAM. Another way to think of this is a list of open loops. Projects do not need to be listed in any particular order, whether by size or by priority. They just need to be on a master list so you can review them regularly enough to ensure that appropriate next actions have been defined for each of them. An example projects list can be found in the PDF included with this program. You don't actually do a project. You can only do action steps related to it. When enough of the right action steps have been taken, some situation will have been created that matches your initial picture of the outcome closely enough that you can call it done. The list of projects is the compilation of finish lines we put before us to keep our next actions moving on all tracks appropriately. Project support material. For many of your projects, you will accumulate relevant information that you will want to organize by theme or topic or project name. Your projects list will be merely an index. All of the details, plans, and supporting information that you may need as you work on your various projects should be contained in separate file folders, computer files, notebooks, or binders. Support materials and reference files. Once you've organized your project support material by theme or topic, you'll probably find that it's almost identical to your reference material and could be kept in the same reference file system. A, quote, wedding file, unquote, could be kept in the general reference files, for instance. The only difference is that in the case of active projects, support material may need to be reviewed on a more consistent basis to ensure that all the necessary action steps are identified. I usually recommend that people store their support materials out of sight. If you have a good working reference file system close enough at hand, you may find that that's the simplest way to organize them. There will be times, though, when it'll be more convenient to have the materials out and instantly in view and available, especially if you're working on a hot project that you need to check references for several times during the day. File folders in wire standing holders or in stackable trays within easy reach can be practical for this kind of pending paperwork. The next action categories. As the workflow diagram makes clear, the next action decision is central. That action needs to be the next physical visible behavior, without exception, on every open loop. Any less than 2-minute actions that you perform, and all other actions that have already been completed, do not, of course, need to be tracked. They're done. What does need to be tracked is every action that has to happen at a specific time or on a specific day. Enter these in your calendar. Those that need to be done as soon as they can. Add these to your next actions lists. And all those that you are waiting for others to do. Put these on a waiting for list. Calendar. Reminders of actions you need to take fall into two categories. Those about things that have to happen on a specific day or time, and those about things that just need to get done as soon as possible. Your calendar handles the first type of reminder. Three things go on your calendar. First, time-specific actions. Next, day-specific actions. And finally, day-specific information. Time-specific actions. This is a fancy name for appointments. Often the next action to be taken on a project is attending a meeting that's been set up to discuss it. Simply tracking that on the calendar is sufficient. Day-specific actions. These are things that you need to do sometime on a certain day, but not necessarily at a specific time. Perhaps you told Miyoko you would call her on Friday to check that the report you're sending her is okay. She won't have the report until Thursday, and she's leaving the country on Saturday, so Friday is the time window for taking the action, but anytime Friday will be fine. That should be tracked on the calendar for Friday, but not tied to any particular time slot. It should just go on the day. It's useful to have a calendar on which you can note both time-specific and day-specific actions. Day-specific information. The calendar is also the place to keep track of things you want to know about on specific days, not necessarily actions you'll have to take, but rather information that may be useful on a certain date. This might include directions for appointments, activities that other people, family or staff, will be involved in then, or events of interest. It's also helpful to put short-term tickler information here too, such as a reminder to call someone after the day they return from the vacation. No more daily to-do lists. Those three things are what go on the calendar and nothing else. I know this is heresy to traditional time management training, which has almost universally taught that the daily to-do list is key. But such lists don't work for two reasons. First, constant new input and shifting tactical priorities reconfigure daily work so consistently that it's virtually impossible to nail down to-do items ahead of time. Having a working game plan as a reference point is always useful, but it must be able to be renegotiated at any moment. Trying to keep a list in writing on the calendar, which must then be rewritten on another day if items don't get done, is demoralizing and a waste of time. The next actions list that I advocate will hold all of those action reminders, even the most time-sensitive ones, and they won't have to be rewritten daily. Second, if there's something on a daily to-do list that doesn't absolutely have to get done that day, it will dilute the emphasis on the things that truly do. If I have to call Miyoko on Friday because that's the only day I can reach her, but then I add five other less important or less time-sensitive calls to my to-do list, when the day gets crazy, I may never call Miyoko. My brain will have to take back the reminder that that's the one phone call I won't get another chance at. That's not utilizing the system appropriately. The way I look at it, the calendar should be sacred territory. If you write something there, it must get done that day or not at all. The only rewriting should be for changed appointments. The next actions lists. So where do all your action reminders go? On next actions lists, which, along with the calendar, are at the heart of daily action management organization. Any longer than 2-minute, non-delegatable action you have identified needs to be tracked somewhere. Call Jim Smith, Ray budget meeting. Phone Rachel and Laura's moms about sleepaway camp. And draft ideas, Ray, the annual sales conference, are all the kinds of action reminders that need to be kept in appropriate lists, or buckets, to be assessed as options for what we'll do at any point in time. If you have only 20 or 30 of these, it may be fine to keep them all on one list labeled Next Actions, which you'll review whenever you have any free time. For most of us, however, the number is more likely to be 50 to 150. In that case, it makes sense to subdivide your Next Actions list into categories such as calls to make when you're at a phone or project head questions to be asked at your weekly briefing. Non-actionable items. You need well-organized, discrete systems to handle the items that require no action as well as the ones that do. No-action systems fall into three categories: trash, incubation, and reference. Trash. Trash should be self-evident. Throw away anything that has no potential future action or reference value. If you leave this stuff mixed in with other categories, it will seriously undermine the system. Incubation. There are two other groups of things besides trash that require no immediate action, but this stuff you will want to keep. Here again, it's critical that you separate non-actionable from actionable items. Otherwise, you'll tend to go numb to your piles, stacks, and lists and not know where to start or what needs to be done. Say you pick up something from a memo or read an email that gives you an idea for a project you might want to do someday, but not now. You'll want to be reminded of it again later so you can reassess the option of doing something about it in the future. For example, a brochure arrives in the mail for the upcoming season of your local symphony. On a quick browse, you see that the program that really interests you is still 4 months away, too distant for you to move on it yet. You're not sure what your travel schedule will be that far out. But if you are in town, you'd like to go. What should you do about that? There are two kinds of incubate systems that could work for this kind of thing: someday maybe lists and a tickler file. Someday maybe. It can be useful and inspiring to maintain an ongoing list of things you might want to do at some point, but not now. This is the parking lot for projects that would be impossible to move on at present, but you don't want to forget about entirely. You'd like to be reminded of the possibility at regular intervals. An example of a someday maybe list can be found in the PDF file included with this program. You'll probably have some subcategories in your master someday maybe list, such as CDs I might want, videos to rent, books to read, wine to taste, weekend trips to take, things to do with the kids, seminars to take. You must review this list periodically if you're going to get the most value from it. I suggest you include a scan of the contents in your weekly review. Tickler file. The most elegant version of holding for review is the Tickler file, sometimes also referred to as a suspended or follow-on file. This is a system that allows you to almost literally mail something to yourself for receipt on some designated day in the future. Your calendar can serve the same function. You might remind yourself on your calendar for March 15th, for example, that your taxes are due in a month, or for September 12th that Swan Lake will be presented by the Bolshoi at the Civic Auditorium in 6 weeks. Reference material. Many things that come your way require no action but have intrinsic value as information. You will want to keep and be able to retrieve these as needed. They can be stored in paper-based or digital form. Paper-based material, anything from the menu for a local takeout deli to the plans, drawings, and vendor information for a landscape project, is best stored in efficient physical retrieval systems. These can range from pages in a loose-leaf planner or notebook for a list of favorite restaurants or the phone numbers of the members of a school committee, to whole file cabinets dedicated to the due diligence paperwork for a corporate merger. Electronic storage can include everything from networked database information to ad hoc reference and archive folders located in your communication software. The most important thing to remember here is that reference should be exactly that, information that can be easily referred to when required. Reference systems generally take two forms. 1. Topic and area-specific storage, and 2. General reference files. The first types usually define themselves in terms of how they're stored. For example, a file drawer dedicated to contracts by date, a drawer containing only confidential employee compensation information, or a series of cabinets for closed legal cases that might need to be consulted during future trials. General reference filing. The second type of reference system is one that everyone needs close at hand for storing ad hoc information that doesn't belong in some pre-designated category. You need somewhere to keep the instruction manual for your cell phone, the notes from the meeting about the Smith project, and those few yen that you didn't get to change at the end of your last trip to Tokyo, and that you'll use when you go back there. The lack of a good general reference file can be one of the biggest bottlenecks in implementing an efficient personal action management system. If filing isn't easy and fast, and even fun, you'll tend to stack things instead of filing them. If your reference material doesn't have a nice clean edge to it, the line between actionable and non-actionable items will blur, visually and psychologically, and your mind will go numb to the whole business. Establishing a good working system for this category of material is critical to ensuring stress-free productivity. We will explore it in more detail in Chapter 7. Review. It's one thing to write down that you need milk. It's another to be at the store and remember it. Likewise, writing down that you need to call a friend for the name of an estate attorney is different from remembering it when you're at a phone and have some discretionary time. You need to be able to review the whole picture of your life and work at appropriate intervals and appropriate levels. For most people, the magic of workflow management is realized in the consistent use of the review phase. This is where you take a look at all your outstanding projects and open loops at what I call the 10,000-foot level on a weekly basis. It's your chance to scan all the defined actions and options before you, thus radically increasing the efficacy of the choices you make about what you're doing at any point in time. What to review when? If you set up a personal organization system structured as I recommend, with a projects list, a calendar, next actions list, and a waiting for list, not much will be required to maintain that system. The item you'll probably review most frequently is your calendar, which will remind you about the hard landscape for the day, that is, what things will die if you don't do them. This doesn't mean that the things written on there are the most important in some grand sense, only that they have to get done. At any point in time, knowing what has to get done and when creates a terrain for maneuvering. It's a good habit, as soon as you conclude an action on your calendar, a meeting, a phone call, the final draft of a report, to check and see what else remains to be done. After checking your calendar, you'll most often turn to your next actions list. These hold the inventory of predefined actions that you can take if you have any discretionary time during the day, if you've organized them by context, at home, at computer, in meeting with George, they'll come into play only when those contexts are available. Projects, waiting for, and someday maybe lists need to be reviewed only as often as you think they have to be in order to stop you from wondering about them. Critical Success Factor, the weekly review. Everything that might potentially require action must be reviewed on a frequent enough basis to keep your mind from taking back the job of remembering and reminding. In order to trust the rapid and intuitive judgment calls that you make about actions from moment to moment, you must consistently retrench at some more elevated level. In my experience, with thousands of people, that translates into a behavior critical for success, the weekly review. All of your open loops, that is, projects, active project plans, and next actions, agendas, waiting for, and even someday maybe lists should be reviewed once a week. This also gives you an opportunity to ensure that your brain is clear and that all the loose strands of the past few days have been collected, processed, and organized. If you're like most people, you've found that things can get relatively out of control during the course of a few days of operational intensity. That's to be expected. You wouldn't want to distract yourself from too much of the work at hand in an effort to stay totally squeaky clean all the time. But in order to afford the luxury of getting on a roll with confidence, you'll probably need to clean house once a week. The weekly review is the time to gather and process all your stuff, review your system, update your lists, get clean, clear, current, and complete. Most people don't have a really complete system, and they get no real payoff from reviewing things for just that reason. Their overview isn't total. They still have a vague sense that something may be missing. That's why the rewards to be gained from implementing this whole process are at least geometric. The more complete the system is, the more you'll trust it. And the more you trust it, the more complete you'll be motivated to keep it. The weekly review is a master key to maintaining that standard. Most people feel best about their work the week before their vacation. But it's not because of the vacation itself. What do you do the last week before you leave on a big trip? You clean up, close up, clarify, and renegotiate all your agreements with yourself and others. I just suggest that you do this weekly instead of yearly. Do. The basic purpose of this workflow management process is to facilitate good choices about what you're doing at any point in time. At 10:33 a.m. Monday, deciding whether to call Sandy, finish the proposal, or process your emails will always be an intuitive call. But with the proper pre-planning, you can feel much more confident about your choices. You can move from hope to trust in your actions, immediately increasing your speed and effectiveness. Three models for making action choices. Let's assume for a moment that you're not resisting any of your stuff out of insecurity or procrastination. There will always be a large list of actions that you are not doing at any given moment. So how will you decide what to do and what not to do and feel good about both? The answer is by trusting your intuition. If you have collected, processed, organized, and reviewed all your current commitments, you can galvanize your intuitive judgment with some intelligent and practical thinking about your work and values. I've developed three models that will be helpful for you to incorporate in your decision-making about what to do. They won't tell you answers, whether you call Frederick, email your son at school, or just go have an informal how are you conversation with your secretary, but they will assist you in framing your options more intelligently. And that's something that the simple time and priority management panaceas can't do. 1. The four criterion model for choosing actions in the moment. At 3:22 on Wednesday, how do you choose what to do? There are four criteria you can apply in this order. First, context. Second, time available. Third, energy available. Fourth, priority. Context. A few actions can be done anywhere, like drafting ideas about a project with pen and paper, but most require a specific location, at home, at your office, or having some productivity tool at hand, such as a phone or a computer. These are the first factors that limit your choices about what you can do in the moment. Time available. When do you have to do something else? Having a meeting in 5 minutes would prevent doing many actions that require more time. Energy available. How much energy do you have? Some actions you have to do require a reservoir of fresh, creative mental energy. Others need more physical horsepower. Some need very little of either. Priority. Given your context, time, and energy available, what action will give you the highest payoff? You have an hour, you're in your office with a phone and a computer, and your energy is 7.3 on a scale of 10. Should you call the client back, work on the proposal, process your voicemails and emails, or check in with your spouse to see how his or her day is going? This is where you need to access your intuition and begin to rely on your judgment call in the moment. To explore that concept further, let's examine two more models for deciding what's most important for you to be doing. 2. The threefold model for evaluating daily work. When you're getting things done, or working in the universal sense, there are three different kinds of activities you can be engaged in. First, doing predefined work. Second, doing work as it shows up. Third, defining your work. Doing predefined work. When you're doing predefined work, you're working off your next actions list, completing tasks that you have previously determined need to be done, managing your workflow. You're making the calls you need to make, drafting ideas you want to brainstorm, or preparing a list of things to talk to your attorney about. Doing work as it shows up. Often things come up ad hoc, unsuspected, unforeseen, that you either have to or choose to respond to as they occur. For example, your partner walks into your office and wants to have a conversation about the new product launch. So you talk to her instead of doing all the other things you could be doing. Every day brings surprises, unplanned for things that just show up, and you'll need to expend at least some time and energy on many of them. When you follow these leads, you're deciding by default that these things are more important than anything else you have to do. Defining your work. Defining your work entails clearing up your in-basket, your email, your voicemail, and your meeting notes, and breaking down new projects into actionable steps. As you process your inputs, you'll no doubt be taking care of some less than 2-minute actions and tossing and filing numerous things, another version of doing work as it shows up. A good portion of this activity will consist of identifying things that need to get done sometime, but not right away. You'll be adding to all your lists as you go along. Once you've defined all your work, you can trust that your lists of things to do are complete, and your context, time, and energy available still allow you the option of more than one thing to do. The final thing to consider is the nature of your work and its goals and standards. 3. The six-level model for reviewing your own work. Priorities should drive your choices, but most models for determining them are not reliable tools for much of our real work activity. In order to know what your priorities are, you have to know what your work is, and there are at least 6 different perspectives from which to define that. To use an aerospace analogy, the conversation has a lot to do with the altitude. First, 50,000 feet, life. 40,000 feet, 3 to 5-year vision. 30,000 feet, 1 to 2-year goals. 20,000 feet, areas of responsibility. 10,000 feet, current projects. Runway, current actions. Let's start from the bottom up. Runway, current actions. This is the accumulated list of all the actions you need to take, all the phone calls you have to make, the emails you have to respond to, the errands you've got to run, and the agendas you want to communicate to your boss and your spouse. You'd probably have 300 to 500 hours worth of these things to do if you stopped the world right now and got no more input from yourself or anyone else. 10,000 feet, current projects. Creating many of the actions that you currently have in front of you are the 30 to 100 projects on your plate. These are the relatively short-term outcomes you want to achieve, such as setting up a home computer, organizing a sales conference, moving to a new headquarters, and getting a dentist. 20,000 feet, areas of responsibility. You create or accept most of your projects because of your responsibilities, which for most people can be defined in 10 to 15 categories. These are the key areas within which you want to achieve results and maintain standards. Your job may entail at least implicit commitments for things like strategic planning, administrative support, staff development, market research, customer service, or asset management. and your personal life has an equal number of such focus arenas: health, family, finances, home environment, spirituality, recreation, etc. Listing and reviewing these responsibilities gives a more comprehensive framework for evaluating your inventory of projects. 30,000 feet, 1 to 2 year goals. What you want to be experiencing in the various areas of your life and work 1 to 2 years from now will add another dimension to defining your work. Often, meeting the goals and objectives of your job will require a shift in emphasis of your job focus, with new areas of responsibility emerging. At this horizon, personally, too, there probably are things you'd like to accomplish or have in place, which could add importance to certain aspects of your life and diminish others. 40,000 feet, 3 to 5 year vision. Projecting 3 to 5 years into the future generates thinking about bigger categories: organization strategies, environmental trends, career and life transition circumstances. Internal factors include longer-term career, family, and financial goals and considerations. Outer world issues could involve changes affecting your job and organization, such as technology, globalization, market trends, and competition. Decisions at this altitude could easily change what your work might look like on many levels. 50,000 plus feet, life. This is the big picture view. Why does your company exist? Why do you exist? The primary purpose for anything provides the core definition of what its work really is. It is the ultimate job description. All the goals, visions, objectives, projects, and actions derive from this and lead toward it. These altitude analogies are somewhat arbitrary, and in real life, the important conversations you will have about your focus and your priorities may not fit exactly to one horizon or another. They can provide a useful framework, however, to remind you of the multi-layered nature of your job and resulting commitments and tasks. Obviously, many factors must be considered before you feel comfortable that you've made the best decision about what to do and when. Setting priorities, in the traditional sense of focusing on your long-term goals and values, though obviously a necessary core focus, doesn't provide a practical framework for a vast majority of the decisions and tasks you must engage in day to day. Mastering the flow of your work at all the levels you experience that work provides a much more holistic way to get things done and feel good about it. Part 2 of this audiobook will provide specific coaching about how to use these three models for making action choices and how the best practices for collecting, processing, planning, organizing, and reviewing all contribute to your greatest success with them. Chapter 3, Getting Projects Creatively Underway, the 5 Phases of Project Planning. The key ingredients of relaxed control are 1. Clearly defined outcomes, projects, and the next actions required to move them toward closure, and 2. Reminders placed in a trusted system that is reviewed regularly. This is what I call horizontal focus. Although it may seem simple, the actual application of the process can create profound results. Enhancing vertical focus. Horizontal focus is all you'll need in most situations most of the time. Sometimes, however, you may need greater rigor and focus to get a project under control, to identify a solution, or to ensure that all the right steps have been determined. This is where vertical focus comes in. Knowing how to think productively in this more vertical way and how to integrate the results into your personal system is the second powerful behavior set needed for knowledge work. This kind of thinking doesn't have to be elaborate. Most of the thinking you'll need to do is informal, what I call back-of-the-envelope planning, the kind of thing you do literally on the back of an envelope in a coffee shop with a colleague as you're hashing out the agenda and structure of a sales presentation. In my experience, this tends to be the most productive kind of planning you can do in terms of your output relative to the energy you put into it. True, every once in a while, you may need to develop a more formal structure or plan to clarify components, sequences, or priorities, and more detailed outlines will also be necessary to coordinate more complex situations. If teams need to collaborate about various project pieces, for example, or if business plans need to be drafted to convince an investor you know what you're doing. But as a general rule, you can be pretty creative with nothing more than an envelope and a pencil. The greatest need I've seen in project thinking in the professional world is not for more formal models. Usually the people who need those models already have them or can get them as part of an academic or professional curriculum. Instead, I found the biggest gap to be the lack of a project-focusing model for the rest of us. We need ways to validate and support our thinking, no matter how informal. Formal planning sessions and high-horsepower planning tools, such as project software, can certainly be useful, but too often the participants in a meeting will need to have another meeting, a back-of-the-envelope session, to actually get a piece of work fleshed out and under control. More formal and structured meetings also tend to skip over at least one critical issue, such as why the project is being done in the first place. Or they don't allow adequate time for brainstorming, the development of a bunch of ideas nobody's ever thought about that would make the project more interesting, more profitable, or just more fun. And finally, very few such meetings bring to bear sufficient rigor in determining action steps and accountabilities for the various aspects of a project plan. The good news is there is a productive way to think about project situations and topics that creates maximum value with minimal expenditure of time and effort. It happens to be the way we naturally think and plan, though not necessarily the way we normally plan when we consciously try to get a project under control. In my experience, when people do more planning, more informally and naturally, they relieve a great deal of stress and obtain better results. The Natural Planning Model. You're already familiar with the most brilliant and creative planner in the world, your brain. You yourself are actually a planning machine. You're planning when you get dressed, eat lunch, go to the store, or simply talk. Although the process may seem somewhat random, a quite complex series of steps, in fact, has to occur before your brain can make anything happen physically. Your mind goes through 5 steps to accomplish virtually any task. 1. Defining purpose and principles. 2. Outcome visioning. 3. Brainstorming. 4. Organizing. 5. Identifying next actions. A simple example: planning dinner out. The last time you went out to dinner, what initially caused you to think about doing it? It could have been any number of things: the desire to satisfy hunger, socialize with friends, celebrate a special occasion, sign a business deal, or develop a romance. As soon as any of these turned into a real inclination that you wanted to move on, you started planning. Your intention was your purpose, and it automatically triggered your internal planning process. Your principles created the boundaries of your plan. You probably didn't consciously think about your principles regarding going out to dinner, but you thought within them. Standards of food and service, affordability, convenience, and comfort all may have played a part. In any case, your purpose and principles were the defining impetus and boundaries of your planning. Once you decided to fulfill your purpose, what were your first substantive thoughts? Probably not .2.A.3.B in plan. Your first ideas were more likely things like Italian food at Giovanni's, or sitting at a sidewalk table at the Bistro Cafe. You probably also imagined some positive picture of what you might experience or how the evening would turn out, maybe the people involved, the atmosphere, and or the outcome. That was your outcome visioning. Whereas your purpose was the why of your going out to dinner, your vision was an image of the what, of the physical worlds looking, sounding, and feeling the ways that best fulfilled your purpose. Once you've identified with your vision, what did your mind naturally begin doing? What did it start to think about? What time should we go? Is it open tonight? Will it be crowded? What's the weather like? Should we change clothes? Is there gas in the car? How hungry are we? That was brainstorming. Those questions were part of the naturally creative process that happens once you commit to some outcome that hasn't happened yet. Your brain noticed a gap between what you were looking toward and where you actually were at the time, and it began to resolve that cognitive dissonance by trying to fill in the blanks. This is the beginning of the how phase of natural planning. But it did the thinking in a somewhat random and ad hoc fashion. Lots of different aspects of going to dinner just occurred to you. You almost certainly didn't need to actually write all of them down on a piece of paper, but you did a version of that process in your mind. Once you had generated a sufficient number of ideas and details, you couldn't help but start to organize them. You may have thought or said, first we need to find out if the restaurant is open, or let's call the Andersons and see if they'd like to go out with us. Once you've generated various thoughts relevant to the outcome, your mind will automatically begin to sort them by components or subprojects, priorities, and/or sequences of events. Components would be, we need to handle the logistics, people, and location. Priorities would be, it's critical to find out if the client really would like to go to dinner. Sequences would be, first we need to check whether the restaurant is open, then call the Andersons, then get dressed. Finally, assuming that you're really committed to the project, in this case, going out to dinner, you focus on the next action that you need to take to make the first component actually happen. Call Suzanne's to see if it's open and make the reservation. These five phases of project planning occur naturally for everything you accomplish during the day. It's how you create things: dinner, a relaxing evening, a new product, or a new company. You have an urge to make something happen, you image the outcome, you generate ideas that might be relevant, you sort those into a structure, and you define a physical activity that would begin to make it a reality. And you do all that naturally, without giving it much thought. Natural planning is not necessarily normal. But is the process described above the way your committee is planning the church retreat? Is it how your IT team is approaching the new system installation? Is it how you're organizing the wedding or thinking through the potential merger? Have you clarified the primary purpose of the project and communicated it to everyone who ought to know it? And have you agreed on the standards and behaviors you'll need to adhere to make it successful? Have you envisioned success and considered all the innovative things that might result if you achieved it? Have you gotten all possible ideas out on the table, everything you need to take into consideration that might affect the outcome? Have you identified the mission-critical components, key milestones, and deliverables? Have you defined all the aspects of the project that could be moved on right now, what the next action is for each part, and who's responsible for what? If you're like most people I interact with in a coaching or consulting capacity, the collective answer to these questions is probably not. There are likely to be at least some components of the natural planning model that you haven't implemented. In some of my seminars, I get participants to actually plan a current strategic project that uses this model. In only a few minutes, they walk themselves through all five phases and usually end up being amazed at how much progress they've made compared with what they've tried to do in the past. One gentleman came up afterwards and told me, "I don't know whether I should thank you or be angry. I just finished a business plan I've been telling myself would take months, and now I have no excuses for not doing it." You can try it for yourself right now if you like. Choose one project that is new or stuck, or that could simply use some improvement. Think of your purpose. Think of what a successful outcome would look like. Where would you be physically, financially, in terms of reputation or whatever? Brainstorm potential steps. Organize your ideas. Decide on the next actions. Are you any clearer about where you want to go and how to get there? The unnatural planning model. To emphasize the importance of utilizing the natural planning model for the more complex things we're involved with, let's contrast it with the more normal model used in most environments, what I call unnatural planning. When the good idea is a bad idea. Have you ever heard a well-intentioned manager start a meeting with the question, "Okay, so who's got a good idea about this?" What is the assumption here? Before any evaluation of what's a good idea can be trusted, the purpose must be clear, the vision must be well-defined, and all the relevant data must have been collected or brainstormed and analyzed or organized. What's a good idea is a good question, but only when you're about 80% of the way through your thinking. Starting there would probably blow anyone's creative mental fuses. Trying to approach any situation from a perspective that's not the natural way your mind operates will be difficult. People do it all the time, but it almost always engenders a lack of clarity and increased stress. In interactions with others, it opens the door for egos, politics, and hidden agendas to take over the discussion. Generally speaking, the most verbally aggressive will run the show. And if it's just you, attempting to come up with a good idea before defining your purpose, creating a vision, and collecting lots of initial bad ideas is likely to give you a case of creative constipation. Let's blame Mrs. Williams. If you're like most people in our culture, the only formal training you've ever had in planning and organizing proactively was in the fourth or fifth grade. And even if that wasn't the only education you've had in this area, it was probably the most emotionally intense, meaning it sank in the deepest. Mrs. Williams, my fourth grade teacher, had to teach us about organizing our thinking. It was in her lesson plans. We were going to learn to write reports. But in order to write a well-organized, successful report, what did we have to write first? That's right, an outline. Did you ever have to do that? Create an outline to begin with? Did you ever stare at a Roman numeral 1 at the top of your page for a torturous period of time and decide that planning and organizing ahead of time were for people very different from you? Probably. In the end, I did learn to write outlines. I just wrote the report first, then made up an outline from the report after the fact. That's what most people learned about planning from our educational system. And I still see outlines done after the fact just to please the authorities. In the business world, they're often headed goals and objectives, but they still have very little to do with what people are doing or what they're inspired about. These documents are sitting in drawers and in emails somewhere, bearing little relationship to operational reality. The reactive planning model. The unnatural planning model is what most people consciously think of as planning. And because it's so often artificial and irrelevant to real work, people just don't plan, at least not on the front end. They resist planning meetings, presentations, and strategic operations until the last minute. But what happens if you don't plan ahead of time? In many cases, crisis. Didn't you get the tickets? I thought you were going to do that. Then, when the urgency of the last minute is upon you, the reactive planning model ensues. What's the first level of focus when the stuff hits the fan? Action. Work harder. Overtime. More people. Get busier. And a lot of stressed out people are thrown at the situation. Then, when having a lot of busy people banging into each other doesn't resolve the situation, someone gets more sophisticated and says, "We need to get organized." Catching on now? Then people draw boxes around the problem and label them, or redraw the boxes and relabel them. At some point, they realize that just redrawing boxes isn't really doing much to solve the problem. Now someone, much more sophisticated, suggests that more creativity is needed. Let's brainstorm. With everyone in the room, the boss asks, "Okay, so who's got a good idea here?" Thank you, Mrs. Williams. When not much happens, the boss may surmise that his staff has used up most of its internal creativity. Time to hire a consultant. Of course, if the consultant is worth his salt, at some point he's probably going to ask the big question, "So what are you really trying to do here anyway?" Vision and purpose. The reactive style is the reverse of the natural model. It will always come back to a top-down focus. It's not a matter of whether the natural planning model will be done, just when and at what cost. Natural planning techniques, the five phases. It goes without saying, but still it must be said again, thinking in more effective ways about projects and situations can make things happen sooner, better, and more successfully. So, if our minds plan naturally anyway, what can we learn from that? How can we use that model to facilitate getting more and better results in our thinking? Let's examine each of the five phases of natural planning and see how we can leverage these contexts. Purpose. It never hurts to ask the why question. Almost anything you're currently doing can be enhanced and even galvanized by more scrutiny at this top level of focus. Why are you going to your next meeting? What's the purpose of your task? Why are you having friends over for a barbecue in the backyard? Why are you hiring a marketing director? Why do you have a budget? I admit it, this is nothing but advanced common sense. To know and to be clear about the purpose of any activity are prime directives for clarity, creative development, and cooperation. But it's common sense that's not commonly practiced, simply because it's so easy for us to create things, get caught up in the form that we've created, and let our connection with our real and primary intentions slip. I know, based upon thousands of hours spent in many offices with many sophisticated people, that the why question cannot be ignored. When people complain to me about having too many meetings, I have to ask, what is the purpose of the meetings? When they ask, who should I invite to the planning session, I have to ask, what's the purpose of the planning session? Until we have the answer to my questions, there's no possible way to come up with an appropriate response to theirs. The value of thinking about why. Here are just some of the benefits of asking why. It defines success. It creates decision-making criteria. It aligns resources. It motivates. It clarifies focus. It expands options. Let's take a closer look at each one of these in turn. It defines success. People are starved for wins these days. We love to play games and we like to win, or at least be in a position where we could win. And if you're not totally clear about the purpose of what you're doing, you have no chance of winning. Purpose defines success. It's the primal reference point for any investment of time and energy, from deciding to run for elective office to designing a form. Ultimately, you can't feel good about a staff meeting unless you know what the purpose of the meeting was. And if you want to sleep well, you'd better have a good answer when your board asks you why you fired your VP of marketing or hired that hotshot MBA as your new finance director. You won't really know whether or not your business plan is any good until you hold it up against the success criterion that you defined by answering the question, why do we need a business plan? It creates decision-making criteria. How do you decide whether to spend the money for a five-color brochure or just to go with two-color? How do you know whether it's worth hiring a major web design firm to handle your new website? It all comes down to purpose. Given what you're trying to accomplish, are these resource investments required? And if so, which ones? There's no way to know until the purpose is clarified. It aligns resources. How should we spend our staffing allocation in the corporate budget? How do we best use the cash flow right now to maximize our viability as a retailer over the next year? Should we spend more money on the luncheon or the speakers for the monthly association meeting? In each case, the answer depends on what we're really trying to accomplish, the why. It motivates. Let's face it, if there's no good reason to be doing something, it's not worth doing. I'm often stunned by how many people have forgotten why they're doing what they're doing, and by how quickly a simple question like, why are you doing that, can get them back on track. It clarifies focus. When you land on the real purpose for anything you're doing, it makes things clearer. Just taking 2 minutes and writing out your primary reason for doing something invariably creates an increased sharpness of vision, much like bringing a telescope into focus. Frequently, projects and situations that have begun to feel scattered and blurred grow clearer when someone brings it back home by asking, what are we really trying to accomplish here? It expands options. Paradoxically, even as purpose brings things into pinpoint focus, it opens up creative thinking about wider possibilities. When you really know the underlying why, for the conference, for the staff party, for the elimination of the management position, or for the merger, it expands your thinking about how to make the desired result happen. When people write out their purpose for a project in my seminars, they often claim it's like a fresh breeze blowing through their mind, clarifying their vision of what they're doing. Is your purpose clear and specific enough? If you're truly experiencing the benefits of a purpose focus, motivation, clarity, decision-making criteria, alignment, and creativity, then your purpose probably is specific enough. But many, quote, purpose statements, unquote, are too vague to produce such results. To have a good department, for example, might be too broad a goal. After all, what constitutes a good department? Is it a group of people who are highly motivated, collaborating in healthy ways, and taking initiative? Or is it a department that comes in under budget? In other words, if you don't really know when you've met your purpose or when you're off track, you don't have a viable directive. The question, how will I know when this is off purpose, must have a clear answer. Principles. Of equal value as prime criteria for driving and directing a project are the standards and values you hold. Although people seldom think about these consciously, they are always there. And if they're violated, the result will inevitably be unproductive distraction and stress. A great way to think about what your principles are is to complete this sentence. I would give others totally free rein to do this as long as they what? What policies, stated or unstated, will apply to your group's activities? As long as they stayed within budget, satisfied the client, ensured a healthy team, promoted a positive image. It can be a major source of stress when others engage in or allow behavior that's outside your standards. If you never have to deal with this issue, you're truly graced. If you do, some constructive conversation about and clarification of principles could align the energy and prevent unnecessary conflict. You may want to begin by asking yourself, what behavior might undermine what I'm doing, and how can I prevent it? That will give you a good starting point for defining your standards. Another great reason for focusing on principles is the clarity and reference point they provide for positive conduct. How do you want or need to work with others on this project to ensure its success? You yourself are at your best when you're acting how. Whereas purpose provides the juice and the direction, principles define the parameters of action and the criteria for excellence of behavior. Vision, outcome. In order most productively to access the conscious and unconscious resources available to you, you must have a clear picture in your mind of what success would look, sound, and feel like. Purpose and principles furnish the impetus and the monitoring, but vision provides the actual blueprint of the final result. This is the what instead of the why. What will this project or situation really be like when it successfully appears in the world? For example, graduates of your seminar are demonstrating consistently applied knowledge of the subject matter. Market share has increased 2% within the Northeastern region over the last fiscal year. Your daughter is clear about your guidelines and support for her first semester in college. The power of focus. Since the 1960s, thousands of books have expounded on the value of appropriate positive imagery and focus. Forward-looking focus has even been a key element in Olympic-level sports training, with athletes imagining the physical effort, the positive energy, and the successful result to ensure the highest level of unconscious support for their performance. We know that the focus we hold in our minds affects what we perceive and how we perform. This is as true on the golf course as it is in a staff meeting or during a serious conversation with a spouse. My interest lies in providing a model for focus that is dynamic in a practical way, especially in project thinking. When you focus on something, the vacation you're going to take, the meeting you're about to go into, the product you want to launch, that focus instantly creates ideas and thought patterns you wouldn't have had otherwise. Even your physiology will respond to an image in your head as if it were reality. The Reticular Activating System. The May 1957 issue of Scientific American contained an article describing the discovery of the reticular formation at the base of the brain. The reticular formation is basically the gateway to your conscious awareness. It's the switch that turns on your perception of ideas and data, the thing that keeps you asleep even when music's playing, but wakes you if a special little baby cries in another room. Just like a computer, your brain has a search function, but it's even more phenomenal than a computer's. It seems to be programmed by what we focus on, and more primarily, what we identify with. It's the seat of what many people have referred to as the paradigms we maintain. We notice only what matches our internal belief systems and identified contexts. If you're an optometrist, for example, you'll tend to notice people wearing eyeglasses across a crowded room. If you're a building contractor, you may notice the room's physical details. If you focus on the color red right now and then just glance around your environment, if there is any red at all, you'll see even the tiniest bits of it. The implications of how this filtering works, how we are unconsciously made conscious of information, could fill a week-long seminar. Suffice it to say that something automatic and extraordinary happens in your mind when you create and focus on a clear picture of what you want. Clarifying outcomes. There is a simple but profound principle that emerges from understanding the way your perceptive filters work. You won't see how to do it until you see yourself doing it. It's easy to envision something happening if it has happened before or you have had experience with similar successes. It can be quite a challenge, however, to identify with images of success if they represent new and foreign territory. That is, if you have few reference points about what an event might actually look like and little experience of your own ability to make it happen. Many of us hold ourselves back from imaging a desired outcome unless someone can show us how to get there. Unfortunately, that's backward in terms of how our minds work to generate and recognize solutions and methods. One of the most powerful skills in the world of knowledge work, and one of the most important to hone and develop, is creating clear outcomes. This is not as self-evident as it may sound. We need to constantly define and redefine what we're trying to accomplish on many different levels and consistently reallocate resources toward getting these tasks completed as effectively and efficiently as possible. What will this project look like when it's done? How do you want the client to feel? And what do you want him to know and do after the presentation? Where will you be in your career 3 years from now? How would the ideal VP of finance do his job? What would your website really look like and have as capabilities if it could be the way you wanted it? Outcome vision can range from a simple statement of the project, such as finalized computer system implementation, to a completely scripted movie depicting the future scene in all of its glorious detail. Here are three basic steps for developing a vision. First, view the project from beyond the completion date. Second, envision wild success. Suspend the yeah, but. And third, capture features, aspects, qualities you imagine in place.